the first thing I want to do is to have you tell me a little bit about why the central jurisdiction even existed.
Yes, I'll give you the short version, and then if you want to ask other questions.
Okay, all right.
You'll have to understand the whole culture of slavery, because in 1844, when the church really divided, the issue of slavery was, without a doubt, the overwhelming issue that divided the church. And the church stayed divided, Methodist Church South and Methodist Episcopal Church, for 95 years. Then when a union was finally consummated, there were strong voices of people, especially in the South, who did what the nation had been doing for over a century, insisted upon segregation. And so, pure and simple, the central jurisdiction was, without a doubt, sociologically speaking, a segregated unit. That's the short version of it.
What I don't understand is why there were so many Methodists who just decided to stay after there was this just very clear segregation. Why would anyone want to be part of the church when the church was saying, we're going to set you aside and you're not going to be part of us?
Well, the record is pretty clear, even though it's difficult to understand in this context of 2005. One of the great laypersons of the central jurisdiction, as it became, made a speech which I have quoted in my book, in which he pointed out that we knew full well, the we being black people, we knew full well that we did not like the segregation. But our feeling was, as it was in the nation, that we were here at the beginning of the church, as we were here at the beginning of the nation. And the same question is, why would you stay in a country that segregated you for well over a century? And so he made it clear in that speech, Dr. Matthew Simpson Davidge, that we would accept this sort of compromise because we belong to the church and have as much right to stay in it as anybody else. But we would work assiduously, as we did, to eliminate the central jurisdiction. And, of course, in 27 years, it was eliminated.
1968, of course, was the year that it was eliminated. But when did you start hearing of or seeing steam pick up as far as people saying, I think now's the time. I think that we can make this thing happen where we get rid of central jurisdiction and we have an integrated church?
In the Journal of the Central Jurisdiction, in the first journal of 1940, the Episcopal address was delivered by Bishop Alexander P. Shaw of the Central Jurisdiction. To quote him, not exactly, but in essence, he said, we have accepted this arrangement because there are many people in the church who need a little coddling. That was his word. But this is not an arrangement that we consider to be permanent. So the resistance actually started as soon as the jurisdiction was formed. Then in 1944, there was the talk of a committee. In 1948, there was an actual committee to study the central jurisdiction. And in 1960, I became the chairman of a committee that actually wrote the plan, our plan for desegregation from our standpoint.
And you wrote that in 1960, yet it took till 1968. Tell me about that struggle during that time to get this passed.
There were several things during that struggle, some of them good and some of them do not reflect well on the life of the church. But remember, we're looking back on the time now when American race relations, at least the conscience on American race relations, is quite different from what it was back in 1948, 52, 56, mm-hmm. and 60. The struggle was of two kinds from our standpoint. If one reads the resolution in 1948 adopted by the central jurisdiction, it is very clear that that resolution, adopted almost unanimously, called for a study of the jurisdiction, but also a plan for, it didn't exactly call for inclusion, but it called for a statement of the irrationality of the jurisdiction and a clear sign of the refusal to be segregated. That was in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were, as you will remember, approaches to the General Conference in 1952. And that was the first sign that the General Conference would do anything. In 1956, we had what was called Amendment 9, which allowed some black churches to transfer to white areas. But it was a very, very difficult process. In 1960, that's the time when our committee was formed in the central jurisdiction. So the legal battle took place mostly in the central jurisdiction. And then from 1952 to 56 to 60 in the General Conference. But the untold story is what some of us did with what we call the allies of the church. A few people in the South and many in the North who worked with us to try to train the conscience of the church against segregation and for what was then called integration. That's a long story, and I will not try to tell it unless you have questions about it.
So, but there were quite a few people that starting in the 50s, well, I'm sure starting from the very beginning, but really the ball started rolling in the 50s where you had a lot of white members of the church who said, this isn't right. And then it started picking up with the formation of some plans, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In 1968, that was such a year of change for America. America was going through so much. Do you recall what it was like during that period of time in America and in the changes that were going on in the church?
Yes, I do. But 1964 was actually much more crucial than 68.
Tell me about that.
1964, at the Central Jurisdictional Conference, we presented our report, the we being the committee to study the central jurisdiction, at which time we prepared ourselves for the gradual dissolution, as it turned out to be, of the central jurisdiction. That is the time when I was elected as the next to the last bishop of the central jurisdiction, but I was transferred to the North Central and assigned eventually to Iowa as the first black bishop to serve in the North Central jurisdiction. That was a very, very drastic change. Bishop Prince Taylor had at the same time gone to New Jersey. The atmosphere at that time was very, very difficult in race relations. Largely because the civil rights movement of 1955 had gained ascendancy, and there were tensions and riots and freedom rides and all sorts of difficulties relating to these changes. By 1968, of course, it became even more intense. That's the year that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and all sorts of riots took place in many places. I remember that kind of transition very well.
Do you think the changes would have occurred in the church if this had not been occurring in the nation?
Personally, I doubt it, because it was a wave of national changes that finally persuaded the church that something had to be done. If you read the Daily Christian Advocate of 1964, you'll discover that the church was very, very intensely concerned about segregation, but there were very strong efforts to hold on to the past. However, the motion to do something about the jurisdiction and end segregation was actually a part of the legislation. And that is the only reason why, in 1967, an odd-numbered year, the central jurisdiction held its last session. And so it was the national mood, as it was the national mood in segregation, that brought about the central jurisdiction. It was the national mood in 1964 and 68 that helped to dissolve the central jurisdiction.
Would you describe the mood after the central jurisdiction was dissolved as being one of elation or one of apprehension? What were the feelings of you, of the people that you worked with, of the church at that time?
Well, by that time I was in Iowa, and so I did not understand all of the feelings that were going on. It was enough of a job for me to try to be the best bishop that I could be in a strange area, a long way from home, in an area that was predominantly white, with only 50 black members among 300,000. Mm. And so I did not really live in the atmosphere of the central jurisdiction from 1964, and therefore I can only interpret it from a distance. Feelings, however, just before that took place were mixed. We did not know how people would react to the abolition of the central jurisdiction. We were pretty sure that the South, especially the Deep South, would find this to be a very difficult process. That's why I went to Iowa. Your southern-born bishop does not go to Iowa unless there's a very good reason for it. That's why Bishop Prince Taylor went to New Jersey. You don't go to a Deep South state when you are eliminating segregation. At least those were the realities of that time. And so that's my short version of how we felt just before I went to Iowa. Once in Iowa, of course, I had my hands quite full.
How quickly did you start seeing change in the church?
Well, the truth of the matter is that was a matter of how much change was discernible. There were those in the church who actually thought that the central jurisdiction would remain a permanent arrangement, just as there were those in the nation. We have to remember that every step toward eliminating segregation from 1877 to 1968 in the nation and in the church was a very difficult process. America did not do this easily, nor did the church. There is no evidence that this was an easy process. So we began to see changes only through some of the prophets of the church, both lay men and lay women, both pastors and district superintendents, but there were few. The number began to grow, and as the chairman of a committee eliminating segregation, I was asked to speak to many of these people in the early days of the 1960s, mostly in the North, rarely, if ever, in the South. And that's when changes began to take place, as people began to understand that the time for segregation was over in America, and it was over in the church.
One thing that I have run across when I was reading a lot of this research is often when you talk about the central jurisdiction, you also talk about the sense of community, though, and the sense and the leadership that was developed in there. So there were some good things about the organization in that it developed leadership, and it also established strong relationships. Tell me a little bit about the sense of community that was in that central jurisdiction.
Well, it must be remembered that black people have had to have this sense of community with or without a central jurisdiction. I'm old enough to remember the days before the central jurisdiction began. We couldn't live in hotels, so we had to live in each other's homes. That was community. Once the central jurisdiction was formed, we lived in each other's homes with the knowledge that we had a structure then that we could talk about, that we could plan for, that we could participate in. But the sense of community did not come with the central jurisdiction, and some of the people who never wanted to get rid of the central jurisdiction kept saying, but look, you're developing leadership. They never asked the question of how much leadership would develop if we were integrated. My leadership, of course, was nurtured in the central jurisdiction, but I tried to live in such a way that it would have been nurtured in the North Central as well. And so, yes, there was a wonderful sense of fellowship and community. But one can romanticize that to the place when it becomes an excuse for maintaining a segregated unit. We had long had fellowship in the black community because we were forced to be gracious to each other because we could not live anywhere else. The hotels were not open. The restaurants were not open. And that was an American condition for well over a century and a half. We were not bitter about it. We just did what we had to do by loving each other, living with each other, helping each other, and enjoying each other.
Very good point. How much work do you think still needs to be done?
Well, I think the whole scene has shifted in several different ways, and I'd like to just suggest one or two. Obviously, the work of legal segregation has been completed in the church as it has been in the nation. That, however, is actually not where our main issues are now. Our main issues now have to do with the production of leadership for the Church of Jesus Christ. Quite aside from racial lines, it has to do with a global point of view in which the increasingly diverse nation learns to deal with that. Black people are no longer the largest minority. Hispanic people are, for example. The issues are quite different, in my judgment. So the church has a job of doing one or two things, and I'll mention only one or two. Obviously, there are still vestiges of racism that are deplorable because they are so subtle that they can easily be explained away, and I won't make that a long story. Therefore, we have the work of dealing with those, making decisions quite beyond racial issues, which is what I had to do in Iowa for 12 years. And Ohio for 12 years. And so my thinking was that racial then. I had very few black people. My thinking had to deal with the whole issue of justice, the issues of sexism, and some of the issues that related to power in general. Having said that, we now have the job, in my judgment, of remembering the reason why the church exists in the first place, that is making disciples of Jesus Christ and allowing our minds to get out of the boxes that they've been in for centuries. The boxes that keep us still thinking in male dominance terms, in racial terms, in American triumphalist terms, and I could go on and on, but I think I've suggested what I have in mind.
That's a huge task.
It is indeed, and that's why I hope I'm an old man now, but I hope we can see that task, because it's a very exciting task. We can no longer afford to be a nation or a church that cannot work with people as allies all the world over. We are, of course, startled when tsunamis come, but it only brings us into the harsh realization that this world is still one world as it always has been. And so we can't afford to live in the racial boxes, the gender boxes, and the boxes between rich and poor that we've built over all these years. And if I can think that at 85, I hope that some prophet can begin to think it at 40.
Do you think that there is that kind of can-do spirit that existed in the 60s with the people that you worked with? Do you think that the church has that kind of spirit today?
I don't want to sound like, you know, like an old prophet, but in terms of where we've come in technology and other things, there's a tremendous need for that kind of spirit. We don't have the same kind of zeal. We don't have the same kind of prophetic approach. I think the last political elections made that very clear. There's been a dumbing down and a manipulation in the nation that I, for one, deplore. All sorts of spins to things, and the greed that we've seen in the nation. You're well aware of these.
Right, right.
And the kinds of things that call for a John the Baptist kind of approach again. And I'm not seeing enough of that.
Well, one last question for you. As a United Methodist, I did not know about the central jurisdiction until I started doing research on this.
Yes.
How important is it that the church as a whole educate the congregations about central jurisdiction?
I think it's vitally important for for several reasons. I'll give only one or two. Number one, having lived through over a third of the lifetime of the United Methodist Church, there are people who actually think that there is no race problem. There never was one. Every now and then one is astounded by these. We have to see how far the church came and how recent was that coming. We're only 37 years away from the central jurisdiction. This is the 21st century. The world has moved on. And it's important to have the perspective that you got through research so that you can see that we have no basis for triumphalism either in the nation or in the church, because most of our history has been a history of segregation, discrimination. And I do not say this in bitterness. I was one of those who stayed with the church throughout all those years. Secondly, it's important for the reason of hope. While I think I try to be a prophetic realist, I have a tremendous lot of hope of what the church can do and what God wants to do through the church, even the United Methodist Church. And your research gives you that kind of perspective, which you would not have unless you had done it. So those are my two major reasons for being thankful that you did the research that gives you a different perspective.
Yes, and hopefully we can educate others about it, too.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, to work with you.
Here, too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.